Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Bichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Wednesday, April 24th, 2024. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives. As we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered, these tools are available absolutely free through the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice on the website at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the two words that say start here in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of that book contains a narrative description and explanation of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for over 19 years now to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to turn any negative emotional experience I have into part of the infallible guidance system that each and every one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Click the link, download it, print it off, copy it as often as you'd like, and use it over and over and over again, absolutely free. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words, Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. And if you choose to do that, before you're done typing the word forgiveness, you'll see the glowing heart icon. If you tap on that, it will let you download a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet. It contains an abbreviated version of that worksheet process. And it contains a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. We hope people do all of that soon and often, primarily because it tends to improve the quality of people's lives the more they actively apply these tools in their lives, and secondarily because it tends to prompt comments, questions, answers, and testimonials. And if you have any of those to share with us, we would appreciate you doing so by giving us a call at 563-999-3581. Call that number, press 1 on your phone, and I'll put a little icon of a hand by your phone number. I can then turn on the microphone, announce you by your area code, and we can have a conversation. Alternatively, you can send us an email. You can email me at tjh@mindshifters-academy.org, and or you can email Jeannie at jeannie@whyagain.org. That's whyagain.org. So, if you send us an email, we'll address it on the internet show, and then as time allows, send you notice about what day and time that occurred so we can have you listen back to the archive for your feedback or input. And we're just greatly appreciative anytime anybody chooses to do that, because getting feedback from you about how these things are landing, what you're struggling with, what you're working on, just makes it that much easier for us to live into our intention with this work. The intention we have with this work is to be a service, And if you'll let us know what we can do to be of service, it just makes it a lot easier, and we're grateful whenever that happens. So we have plenty of time for comments and questions today. Again, the call-in number is 563-999-3581. Remember to press 1 on your phone if you call that number and have something to contribute or a question to ask. It's been a very full week for me. As I mentioned yesterday, I did one of the more important interviews I've done in the past 4 years with Robert Whitaker from Mad in America. And I was also talking to people about the process of nonviolent communication as laid out by Marshall Rosenberg in his book on nonviolent communication. And I've also talked about how as I was trying to get through that book, it was quite a struggle because he uses the word needs over and over and over again in a way that to me was clashing with different meanings and what Michael Rice would call good regulatory speech, etc. So I finally got through it with this delightful insight that if you just switch the word need for the word goal as you're reading his book or listening to his Sounds True classes on that, it fits almost perfectly with everything Dr. Michael Rice teaches and is taught in the Mind Shifters support groups and here on the internet show Mind Shifters Radio. Another discovery that I made, which is because the work with the book by Marshall Rosenberg and or the Sounds True audio class with him is many hours long. But there's also basically just about an hour worth of listening available through Audible. I'm not sure if it's in print, but the title of this piece is The Art of Nonviolent Communication. The subtitle is A Handbook for Turning Conflict into Connection. And it's written and read by Micah Salaberrios, M-I-C-A-H Salaberrios, S-A-L-A-B-E-R-R-I-O-S. And it's under like $5 to buy the audio, and it's only about an hour long. And it is a wonderful overview and summary of the nonviolent communication system, technique, theory, whatever you want to call it, that Dr. Rosenberg created. So if you're looking for a way to see the similarities between this work and Dr. Michael Rice's work, and you don't want to invest the 5+ hours for the nonviolent communication piece available on audio by Marshall Rosenberg, in 1/5 the time, you can get a very good feeling for and some steps to start applying nonviolent communication. And if you've looked at Dr. Michael Rice's responsibility communication and had an experience with that, you'll see tremendous similarities. If you've worked with the Imago Dialogue by Harville Hendricks, you'll see tremendous similarities. If you worked with Robert Bolton's People Skills and Reflective Listening Tools, you'll see tremendous similarities. So it's very solid work. And it's right in line with what we understand works, what we observe on a regular basis works to best benefit in communication with what Dr. Rice would call responsibility communication. So that's just another offering I would put out there. And as I've mentioned, we are wide open for comments, questions, suggestions, answers. As I'm mentioning that yesterday I had one of the more important interviews I've done in the past 4 years, I would put out again this invitation for you to suggest, who do you think we should interview next? What would be of value to have either on the Mind Shifters Radio or presented through the On Your Mind podcast by Journey's Dream, hosted by Journey's Dream? And you can either email me that suggestion or you can call in now. And this is maybe somebody that you listen to their podcast on a regular basis and are getting great benefit from, or you've read a book that they've written that you think is, you know, similar to or in alignment with the work we're doing here on Mind Shifters Radio. It might be, I've had a couple people recommend to me therapists that they know who are just really good at what they do, and they said, hey, try and interview this therapist. So all of that's possible, and we appreciate the leads. Even better is if you know somebody personally and you can do an introductory email, so it's not exactly just a cold call for me to reach out to these people. That's even better. So we had our support group last night, and we did a little bit of processing, and then we listened to a vintage Guy Finley episode that's one of my favorites, where he has three what I consider entertaining stories, all related, all trying to drive home some very useful points. And they have humor, and they have passion in them. And then we had the teaching that arises so often in that support group, which is that at least two of the people who were listening to that, what I consider one of my favorite talks by Guy Finley, at least two of the people were agitated and wanted to argue with what he was saying. And the bottom line in our work is that we understand that if I'm agitated, if I want to argue with what someone's saying, that means I have work to do. I have pain or fear or sadness in me that unless and until I dismantle that pain, fear, and sadness, see the roots of it, and therefore dismantle it, it's going to continue to distort my perception. And I would, you know, if I have any of that upset in me, in Dr. Michael Rice's work, the best thing to do is do some worksheets. Maybe I need to do some EFT tapping to dispel some energy before I can even do the worksheet if I get too agitated. But then I can do the worksheets and I can dismantle the upset. And then I can formulate what Dr. Michael Rice would say would be a responsibility communication, or Marshall Rosenberg or Micah Salaberius would say, let's do a nonviolent communication. Because in the nonviolent communication, I'm just going to describe what happened as best I can without interpretation or coloring it. I'm going to describe what I feel that I know I'm creating in response to that, and how that's impacting me and why. And then I'm going to make just a simple request, not a demand, but a request, which helps me understand what I think might be beneficial and helps anybody that I'm interacting with have access to an intimate part of my life. And gives them an opportunity to step into a co-creative relationship with me. So here's the idea. From the very beginning of The Way of Mastery, it talks about how you don't experience anything beyond your own choices. And You are creating your experience of life with how you choose to focus your mind energy, what you choose to give value to, what you choose to argue for, what you choose to identify with. So here we are in Lesson 17 of The Way of Mastery, and then where we left off was that we were reading a section titled Dismantling the Blocks to Capital S Spirit. Right? This is the whole idea about awakening and being vigilant and how that requires more than mere getting triggered and responding and identifying with things. It requires that you begin to observe and feel and think more deeply about how everything that arises within you is accessible to you. It's being created inside of you. It's not being caused by the outside. And if anything, if you choose to look at it a certain way, you can choose to look at it as though, oh, this series of events is happening for my benefit. So it's resonating the upset I carried with me into this situation. So I now have the opportunity, because I have tools, to dismantle it. The people who were in the support group last night could choose to look at it that way. Oh, I thought I would have yet another group where I just enjoyed listening to what the teacher was saying and I felt good about it. And instead, I have upset in me and I want to argue with what this teacher is saying. And I'm getting the thought over and over again that this teacher is telling me that I'm screwing up in my life and I'm doing it wrong. I'm going to look at that as an opportunity to dismantle those beliefs within me that I must be doing something wrong that I carried with me into this moment. That's how I dismantle anything that would block me from having direct conscious awareness of my true nature as love, my true spirit nature. And this last paragraph of the section we read the last time we were reading from this is, now for all of you that want to quicken that process of awakening, the answer is very, very simple. You simply spend more time building and becoming self-observant. Turn the focus inside yourself every time you're upset. And spend less time being concerned with what's going on in the world around you. And spend zero time, no time at all, blaming the world for what you're experiencing, for your state of being. You don't blame your parents, you don't blame society, you don't blame creation itself, but you're simply owning what you're experiencing and getting curious about it, turning the focus inside, and with childlike curiosity asking, gee, how am I creating this reaction? How am I creating this emotion? How am I creating this interpretation? So the next section of The Way of Mastery is titled Assuming, and this is Lesson 17, Assuming Complete Responsibility and Power. And the text reads, here is an important word that we will share with you. You've heard it many times before. And yet, when you truly reach a point of assuming 100% responsibility for what you think, for what you feel, for what you see, and for what you experience, when you finally do that, that will create a quantum leap in the other direction. It creates a quantum leap toward self-observation, a quantum leap toward the freedom that you are seeking, a quantum leap toward the healing of the soul, a quantum leap toward the realization of your purpose, and a quantum leap toward awakening. What will create that quantum leap? Assuming 100% responsibility for everything you think, everything you feel, everything you see, and everything you experience. The text goes on and says, without it, the spiritual journey never quite gets off the ground, literally. You never quite ascend. And you cannot ascend without the assumption of complete responsibility. You must extricate yourself from the psychic enmeshment with other webs of relationship in the sense that you have come to perceive that they are causing your decisions. In other words, you must assume power, complete power, complete responsibility. You are well aware of those in your third dimensional reality who assume power. You sometimes love them or loathe them, but they are powerful. Can you assume the same power in your own life? Can you come to look at your beloved if you're in a relationship and say something like this, quote, "You know something? This being that I'm living with is not causing how I feel. This being can never fulfill me. This being has nothing that I can take from them in order to fill up my sense of lack. I alone in my journey to creation, to God, to light, to love, I'm alone in that journey, for I abide alone in creation, in the creation, in the mind of the Creator, in God," whatever phrase you want to use. That is, I am an individuated spark of divinity. That individuated spark of divinity is within me. The kingdom of heaven is within me. What I am seeking is within me. And therefore, what fulfills me must come forth from within me. That is why I once said, and this comes from the Thomas Gospels, but the quote here is, "If you do not bring forth what is within you, what is within you will destroy you. If you bring forth what is within you will save you." Now, in this book, it's writing as though Yeshua is speaking this. In our knowledge from the ancient scrolls, the Thomas Gospels, this is one of the sayings in the Thomas Gospels. If you do not bring forth what is within you will destroy you. If you bring forth what is within you will save you. The text continues. If you do not bring forth what is within you, and what is within you is love, is the Christ, is the one mind of the Creator. If you don't bring that forward, you will feel burdened and unfulfilled. Usually, most human beings go through their entire life with a sense of unfulfillment, lamenting what the world has done to them, lamenting the decisions and choices they have made in the past. They become burdened by what is on the outside along with what is in the past. And eventually the body dies and the spirit withers on the vine. And at death, another quantum leap occurs. Right? Talked about how a quantum leap occurs when a soul, a spirit, a mind, a consciousness decides to come into physical being. A quantum leap, a flash of light, a shocking shift of consciousness happens when you choose to take form as a baby, as a fetus growing. And now they're saying at death, another quantum leap occurs. And it is as shocking as the first one, coming from spirit into physical. It's just as every bit as shocking when you go from physical to spirit. At death, another quantum leap occurs that is shocking as they discover themselves to be popped back into another vibrational state. And that shift, that transition is so abrupt that it often triggers great fear. Very few beings upon your plane have entered death consciously. It is indeed time, even for those of you that are hearing this lesson, to simply make a decision. I will enter into the transition called death, and I'll enter into it with deliberate consciousness. I will make sure by beginning now that I carry no resentment, that I have dismantled every judgment I have against everyone for everything. In other words, I will use the process of forgiveness to dismantle the judgments and the false perceptions in my life that have led me to believe somebody did something to me. And then as the body enters that state, I will release the world and I will require nothing of it. I will not long to run off in freedom, and I will experience death consciously. I will notice the subtle energy changes as I flip from this dimension into another at the speed of light. Beloved friends, the invitation here is for us to come to understand at this stage of our journey together the true immensity of who you are and what you are. Understand that you are not so much dealing with, quote, things, close quotes, in the world, as you are dealing with patterns of energy that reflect in some way what is already occurring in your consciousness. If you're experiencing things in the third dimensional plane, it can mean only that you have chosen to vibrate at a certain frequency, or otherwise you could not have had that experience. You could not have had the experience of running into a wall with your body unless you were vibrating at the same rate as the wall. Is it possible to change the vibrational frequency of the physical body? That's a good question. Can I change the vibrational frequency of my physical body? The text says, now listen very carefully. I'm going to say something rather unique. When people ask, is it possible to change the vibrational frequency of the body? My answer is no. It's only possible to change the vibrational frequency of your consciousness out of which the body has emerged. So if Dr. Michael Rice were here, if he were paying attention to this and he was aligning it with his teachings, he would say, hey, if I'm trying to change the vibrational frequencies of my body, I'm dealing with the effect level, not the cause level. So what causes the vibrational frequency that I experience in my body? At the cause level, it's consciousness. You are pure consciousness. You are pure spirit. These are the teachings in this work we've already reached into. So, it is not possible to change things deeply, truly, at the effect level. In order to have any kind of lasting change, I have to go to the cause level, to the level of creation at which something is beginning, is caused, is created. And this teaching just says very clearly, it is not possible to change the frequency of the vibrational frequency of the body. It is only possible to change the vibrational frequency of your consciousness out of which your body has emerged. And so then once you change the frequency of the vibrational frequency of your consciousness, the vibrational frequency of your body changes automatically. The next section is titled Turning Inward. You know, this is one of the things most of us do not like to do. We all have our various reasons for it. I would say one of the biggest reasons that we do not like to do it is because we've not been trained to do it. We've not been introduced to it in a loving format. Most of the time when any of us are introduced to the concept of looking at ourselves, it's with accusation and blame. You just screwed up. What is wrong with you? What are you doing that for? Why don't you change to be what I want you to be? And so these are the ways that most of us are introduced to the concept of looking within. most of us have been introduced to the concept of turning inward with the baggage of blame, bitterness, hurt, and resentment. So this section is titled Turning Inward, and the text reads, "This requires a turning point, a turning about in the seat of the soul, a changing of the momentum of consciousness, not outward, but inward, not as an escape from the world. It is not something you have to do all day, every day. And yet, you spend time in prayer and meditation. You spend time in this process of dismantling your false judgments against others. They call it forgiveness in this book. You spend time breathing and relaxing. You begin to allow changes to occur. Changes in the choices you're making, so that they come more into alignment with your growing understanding of yourself as a creator and as a soul. You begin to change your environment. Maybe you paint the color of the walls in your bedroom a different color. And that color might bring a sense of pleasantness to you. Maybe you change your physical environment completely by moving to a different apartment. Many of you know how perfectly well that often it means the changing of relationships. And initially, it does make sense. We have a lot of people who've come into the support groups over the years, and they say, you know, I want a more loving, peaceful life. I want to get rid of all the drama and trauma in my life. I want to have a healthy relationship. And they start understanding the use of these tools and the principle of 100% responsibility. And then they start realizing that, you know what, I've got several really unhealthy relationships in my life, if not downright abusive relationships in my life. And they start changing them. And then they look at other relationships and they start changing them. And they say, wait a minute, if I keep this up, I'm not going to have any relationships. I'm awakening to the fact that I've established unproductive, unhealthy, perhaps even abusive patterns of interacting with all kinds of people in my life that I've been calling relationship. And I don't really have any relationship with them. They don't really know who I am. I don't really know who they are. I'm relating to my fantasy of them, trying to force or manipulate them to be what I want them to be. And they're spending their time trying to either seduce me or suck up to me. And they're trying to get me to be what they want me to be. And so neither one of us is really in a relationship. And initially, it makes sense to change those relationships. But the text here goes on and says, however, there's a point in which you realize that you could keep changing relationships forever, ad nauseum, it says, and you'd never get anywhere. Dr. Michael Rice calls it the geographic cure, right? You leave a place where you don't like what's happening. You leave a relationship and travel to the other side of the country. And Michael says it this way. And you get off the plane and the person that greets you finishes the sentence that the person that you left on the other continent began. Or the other side of the continent began. So then you realize now it's time to settle down. To be with the one you're with and the ones that you're with, and yet utilize your time with them to discover what patterns have been running you. This might be called time for capital S self-awareness. Turning the momentum of the mind back toward the capital S self. Time to ask yourself, quote, why do I think what I think? Why did I see what I just saw? Why did I react the way I just reacted? Turning the focus inward as I ask those questions. The text reads, eventually the soul that is truly committed to awakening, does not flee uncomfortable situations until it believes it has fully extracted all of the wisdom that it can. There is a way of knowing when that occurs, and we'll get to that later. In short, when there is just a quiet sense of peace, and you can look upon the players in the experiences you have just had and look upon them with perfect equanimity, and you see them as perfectly innocent, and you detect that there is nothing in the body that is not at peace. The heart is not racing, the shoulders are not tight. You truly understand that you are not in fear, then it is time to move on. If there is reactivity in the mind because of anything that emerges in your interaction or relationship with your brothers or sisters, then rest assured your lesson is not complete. If your, quote, principles, close quotes, have been, quote, violated, close quotes, then rest assured there is much still to be learned. Please remember, all events are neutral. In large measure, the process of awakening is a process whereby you dissolve the value you have placed upon certain ideas and perceptions of what life is and what life is for. Yes, there are times when you will be troubled as you come to realize that what you thought the world was for and everything you've been putting your energy into means nothing. Often this precipitates a period of what has been called by certain mystics, quote, the dark night of the soul. Here comes one of my favorite lines in this book. It's really not the dark night of the soul. It's the dark night of the ego, and the awakening of, or the healing of, or the turning toward the soul. So Dr. Michael Rice teaches this very same thing, and he says it in a more extreme way. We've got to heal leaving, never leave, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, at one point I heard him say on the internet show years ago, well, wait a minute, you know, I didn't say never leave. You know, if somebody puts a gun to your head, then sure leave. And my response was, oh, my gosh, I certainly hope people don't wait until somebody has a gun to their head to leave a bad relationship. But the point he's trying to make is that his experience in life is that people leave way too often blaming the other person, thinking that the geographic cure is going to be a solution for them. And it never works because we take our upset with us wherever we go. So he teaches, Jeannie teaches, we've been teaching on the internet show here for 13 years now, that if I accept 100% responsibility for the upsets that I experience in my interactions with people in my life, etc., and then I reach the point where I say, you know what, this isn't good for me, I'm going to leave. Leave. That's your, you have the choice. The Way of Mastery says, make your choice. And if I leave and I have any upset in me at all, I need to, if I'm going to continue growing, if I'm going to continue awakening, I need to keep the focus turned inside myself and ask myself, how am I creating this upset? I can't leave a situation with somebody and immediately feel better because they're not right in front of me and I'm not focused on them and think, oh, I'm so glad I got rid of them. They were the problem. That is putting myself in a prison. If I believe I was upset because so-and-so did this and that, I've just blinded myself to the true source of my upset and I've locked it away in the place where I will only, always, and forever keep running into it until I finally deal with it. That's inside my mind-body-energy system. If I'm blaming anyone, the blame hides my power to create my experience of life. This was in a previous version of Michael Rice's Reality Management Worksheet. It said, with blame I hide my power. And I would stop when we read that line, and I would highlight higher up in the worksheet process, there was a line that said, the truth is, my reality is strictly internal. It's unique to me, and my reality is created by my own thoughts. It's exactly what the Way of Mastery and the Way of Course in Miracles are trying to bring us to. Abraham Hicks's work is trying to bring us to, etc. So that worksheet says that line, all caps, bold, near the top of the worksheet. A little bit later on in the worksheet, it says, with blame I hide my power. And that's also a line that's highlighted in bold. And when I would do the worksheet in the work in the support groups, I would stop and I would ask people, now, do you realize what power you're hiding? And I'd get blank stares from people. And I would come back to the line that says, the truth is, my reality is strictly internal. It's unique to me, and it's created out of my own thoughts. That means I'm creating my experience of life every moment, full stop. So anytime I decide to blame my experience of life or any aspect of it on someone or something outside of me, I'm hiding from myself the fact that I have the power of creation and that I'm actually creating my experience moment to moment. That's what they're talking about here. You can leave relationships when they're abusive. And eventually, what you'll find is you get healthier and healthier relationships, but they aren't perfect. And then you'll have a tendency to say, yeah, but I want something better. And you'll think, I'm not having the experience of myself in a bliss state because X, Y, or Z person is doing A, B, or C thing. And this paragraph says, there will come a time when you need to understand you cannot flee the uncomfortable situations until you've reached a place of complete peace in that situation. That means you've dismantled all of the upsets and the baggage that get stirred up when you choose a certain interpretation of this person or this event that resonates your old baggage, and you clear up the baggage. And when you finally reach the place where your body's in complete peace, your heart is relaxed, your shoulders are relaxed, there's calm, there's recognition of your true nature and the other person's true nature, then when you leave, you don't put yourself in a prison. When you move on to another phase of your life and growth, you're not blaming anyone. And you're not hiding from yourself the baggage, the upset, the trauma that would keep you from experiencing yourself directly, consciously in each new present moment as love, as the creative energy expressing in form. So the text here goes on and says, if there's any reactivity in the mind because of anything that emerges in your relationship with your brothers or sisters, rest assured that your lesson is not complete. There's more learning for you to do here. Remember always that all events are neutral. In large measure, the process of awakening is a process whereby you dissolve the value you've placed on certain ideas and perceptions about what life is and what it's for. Yes, there are times you'll be troubled as you come to realize that what you thought the world was for and everything you've been putting your energy into really means nothing. It was just a fantasy that you made up. And it's okay to have the upset, to feel it, to breathe through it, to recognize it's just an energy, it's just a vibrational pattern, and to recognize it's not the death of the soul, it's not the dark night of the soul, it's awakening to the true nature of the ego and its fantasies about how life should be, and it's moving into acceptance of the flow of life, and it's what this text would call the healing of the soul. The dark night of the ego, not the dark night of the soul, and the healing or awakening of the soul. The text goes on and says, the way of transformation requires the utmost personal responsibility, the utmost personal dedication. No one can do it for you. And the patterns you feel weighed down by, the fears that are yet within the mind, will remain with you for all of eternity until you decide to heal them. From that desire to heal, you will extract and you will attract to yourself the situations, the teachers, the books, the experiences that provide for you the opportunity to heal. There is an acceleration of the healing process only when you completely release any valuation on victimhood. That is the belief that somehow, in some way, someone or something has done something to me. Now, that's a simple thought to hear, and a person can nod their head and say, yes, I agree. However, it's completely another thing to look honestly upon your reactions in life and to make sure that you are not at any time perceiving yourself as a victim. The practice of extending love can often teach you that this is so. When you take a situation that pushes your buttons, so to speak, and you decide to not to flee but to stay, this teaches you the truth, capital T truth, of your reality. This is why the practice of forgiveness and dismantling your negative judgments and perceptions is so extraordinarily valuable. In fact, you could say that ultimately the practice of forgiveness, the practice of dismantling your judgments and every distorted perception that your judgments have left you with, that is the whole of spirituality. That's the totality of spirituality. Why? Because that forgiveness process of dismantling your false beliefs, your false perceptions, your judgments, it means to let the world off the hook, to step out of any sense of victim consciousness. And then even beyond that, to dismantle one's perceptions of oneself for the perceptions you've made in error, perceptions of one's brothers and sisters, perceptions of the world, perceptions of your creator. You dismantle all of them. Any judgments, you dismantle them in that forgiveness process. Ultimately, the text reads, forgiveness is forgiveness of oneself forever allowing delusion to settle into one's old mind, thereby perceiving that you are separate from your creator, separate from the brothers and sisters you're in life with, dissolving, dismantling any perception that would leave you capable of feeling victimized. Forgiveness, this process of dismantling your negative judgments and perceptions, when completed, is the establishment of capital L love. It's the establishment of this direct conscious awareness of your true nature as love. Beloved friends, the text reads, look well and see. Quote, where am I perceiving myself as a victim in the world I see? Am I feeling constrained in my relationship? Do I resent my spouse? Close quotes. The text goes on and says, the spouse is not holding you where you are. The spouse does not have the power to take from you your ability to look with love upon him or her or yourself. The text goes on, is it your job that you hate? No one forces you to drive your car upon the freeway to arrive at your place of employment. No one. And you reply, oh, but I must survive. If that's your reply, then you have made yourself a victim of the perception of the need to survive. Any one of you at any time is perfectly free to drop the valuation that you have placed upon this world, any valuation. As a matter of fact, it happens all the time. People walk away from jobs. People walk away from mortgages and houses. People file bankruptcies. People walk out of relationships. People go back on commitments. It happens all the time on this planet. The text goes on and says, I was once criticized for dropping the valuation that my particular society had sought to implant within me. That particular valuation that said, as a son, I should follow in the footsteps of my father. That valuation said that if the father is a carpenter, then you've got to take over the family business. But I said, I must be about my father's business. And in that case, I spoke, of course, of my heavenly father. I had to know the capital T truth of who I was. And my purpose was to awaken Christ. I broke the traditions. I broke the rules of the family structure within that community, within that time frame. And like many of you, I was a bit of a rebel. And where other children were conforming to the pressures of society, I went off to study with the rabbis and the teachers, to sit in the desert at night, often to not return. Even at the age of 12, I separated myself from my parents at a time of a great festival, and I went to hang out in my father's house and talk with spiritual leaders. Are you willing to break with the conventions of the world in which you live? This could be as simple as saying, instead of gathering with friends to watch movies on a Saturday night, you say, no, I'm going to go into my closet and light a candle and pray for 6 hours. And when they look at you with their eyebrows raised, you simply smile. This is so intense. We had somebody in the support group last night who was just, I wish I had the ability to read this, these quotes of these statements. They were said with such impassioned intensity, and the person was saying, how could you not generate fear in this situation? How could you not? You either do this or you do that, and either one of them is, you're afraid of this happening and that happening, and this is just life. And we're all trained that way. That person in the group last night was not unique. We're all trained to believe that the stuff that's been poured into us, that the conventions of our particular society are what's right. This is literally why we have wars. So the question is, are you willing to break with the conventions of the world in which you live? This could be as simple as instead of going out with friends on a Saturday night, you simply say, nope, no thanks, I'm going to go in my closet and light a candle and pray for 6 hours. And then when they have all kinds of weird comments and judgments and look at you with weird faces, you just smile because you're not concerned with changing their belief system. You're concerned with questioning your own. You're concerned with placing value upon your own growth, your own awakening. The section before this was titled Turning Inward. Actually, I'm still in that section called Turning Inward. The text goes on and asks, in what ways are you conforming to the views that others hold of you and conforming to their need to have you be a certain way? Do you show up at the aunt's birthday party just because the family says you always should, and yet in your heart you have no desire to? The willingness to trust and follow your heart. Following your heart, not following the reactive ego that is often interpreted to be the heart, but following the heart that longs to know your Creator. That willingness to follow your heart is a telltale sign of whether or not one is achieving maturity. Beloved friends, look well in this way of transformation, for you must discover any corner of the mind that is yet holding out the view that life is something which happens to you. Any corner of the mind holding the view that there is something that you are helpless to change. The position of being a victim is a position of loss of power. And Christ is not about loss of power. Unfortunately, it is not so much about going anywhere as much as it is about abiding within. I read the word unfortunately. It's actually the word ultimately. Ultimately, this is not a journey to something. This is about going within. Realizing that this world, as your perception creates it, is unreal. And therefore, it is harmless. And in any situation, it is you as consciousness, as the presence of love, with all power under heaven and earth, to extend only that love, to share only your loving thoughts, to teach only love. And that requires that you let the world off the hook, that you recognize that no one and no thing is in any way ever responsible for your joy or your happiness or your peace. For you have established within your unity the awareness of your connection to the Spirit, capital S Spirit, and creation itself. You've realized the capital S Self, and you look out with equanimity upon a neutral world. And as this physical universe fades from view for the final time, within you there will be no compulsion to avoid it, to run away from it, or to enter it. You will be free. For even as you walk this earth, the body moves, the soul does not. The mind thinks, but the depth of the mind is as still as the ocean. You live, and yet not you, for Christ dwells in you. And wherever you go, the presence of peace enters the room before you. You are awake, and you are free. All because once you made a decision to give up victimhood and to assume responsibility for learning how, in all situations, to be only the presence of love. So turn back then to all of your creations. Is there anything uncomfortable about your past? Turn back to it. Examine it. Feel it. Look at all the patterns that made it come up. Look at the choices you've made that perhaps now you're a bit embarrassed about. And look upon them without judgment, with acceptance, with appreciation, with gratitude. Look at them with curiosity. Learn to look with the wonder and innocence of a child. Perhaps you'll say something like, quote, "That was an interesting decision I made when I was 12 to steal my neighbor's bicycle. I remembered how I ended up in that juvenile hall. What was going on with me just before I made that decision? What pattern was running inside of me?" Just be curious. Allowance, acceptance, surrender, and childlike curiosity. So that's all the time we have for today. We're almost at the end of Lesson 17. I will thank you all for being here and remind us that we come from love. We're made of the stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. Welcome, Jeannie Rice.
Thank you, Dr. Tim. I appreciate it. I hope you have a good rest of your day.
You're welcome and deserving. Have a great show.
Thanks. So welcome, everybody, to the second hour of Mindshifters Radio, and today is Wednesday, April the 24th, 2024. And our call-in number is 563-999-3581. And press 1, and that puts you in the queue to talk to us, and we would love to hear your comments and questions because that makes this your show. And I will while we're waiting on Michael to dial in, start the Podbean here. Multitasking. So Michael and I will be traveling on Friday, and so we're going to do a pre-recorded show of the Beatitudes Part 1. We are going to the beach, Michael J. and Krista and their families, and see the three granddaughters that we don't get to see very often. And we'll be a week with them, but we will be doing the show live for the exception of Friday when we're traveling to get there, and then the next Friday when we're traveling to get back. So, well, I'll be coming back here to Bristol. Michael will be going on to Sarasota, Florida. If you don't know, you can go to our schedules, and you can either scroll down, you know, to events, or you can go to schedules and live events, and there's the flyer and all the information. Michael will be doing a three-day Friday, Saturday, Sunday in Sarasota, Florida at the office of Dr. John LaRance. It's called Advanced Rejuvenation. All that information and the flyer is on the website, and you can pick that up. And then also, just to be aware that Michael is also now doing three-day one-on-one called Quantum Skill Point Intensives, and that also is under schedule and under events. You can pick it up either place and get information about that. So opening different opportunities for people to take the work a little bit deeper. If you know of anyone that's in the Sarasota, Florida area or that would be willing to travel to there, please pass that information along to them so that they can participate with Michael there. I'll be coming back here to Bristol and taking care of Aria because the other set of grandparents are off on a cruise, so somebody has to be here. Anyway, added just a few different things. The article's not complete yet. As soon as Michael completes it, I will be sending out a newsletter with the article in it. I'll also create a page on the website and put it out there so that people can access it. And you say, what article? Well, yes, was it day before yesterday? Michael read an article that he has been writing, and it's on, let's see, I was just making sure of the day that he started reading that. Yes. So you can go back to Monday's show and listen to him read it, or was it? Now I'm doubting myself of when he read it. Now I'm looking. Michael, if you're on, please correct me. Was it day before yesterday? I've been packing and doing so much that my mind's in different directions. I apologize for that. Yeah, I believe that it was Monday, April the 22nd. So, I was trying to skip back through the notes on the radio show to see when it was that you read the article. But it will be on the website when he completes it, which should just be today or tomorrow. Welcome, Michael.
Hopefully. I'm still refining some of the concepts in it and retitling it. So I apologize. I'm not a fast writer. Anyway. Welcome, everybody. Delighted that you're here to take the conversation about first century Aramaic forgiveness to the next level. It'll be interesting to see where it goes. One of the things, you know, from the article, and there have been quite a few questions about it, quite a bit of conversation, and I'm actually kind of playing with perhaps putting a whole other concept in there. You know, when you read through, and I've listened to several different videos on the Book of Daniel and such. And it's interesting that the core principles of healing are there. But if you read through that whole book, it is one book of just absolute mass confusion. And what occurred to me as I touched into that.
You said Daniel, did you mean Job?
Oh, Job, I mean, pardon me. Job, yes, of course. Excuse me. Thank you, sweetie. One of the things that has become clear to me is that, and the book is, you know, perfectly done, Because here's this guy Job, who in every way he can possibly imagine, except in the arena where he's ignorant, he's impeccable, absolutely impeccable. Like, you know, he's the classic, how could bad things happen to good people? And when some crazy stuff starts to happen, he goes into mass confusion, as most everybody does when they go into any form of a disease process, whether it's physical disease, mental, emotional, relational, financial, business. And he goes searching. And so what happens in the book of Job? You know, his troubles start, all his friends come, and everybody's got an opinion. Everybody who knows nothing about healing has an opinion. And they go to blaming God, and they blame Job, and it's this, and it's that, and it's that. And it's interesting, because Job arrived at the answer within minutes of these events happening, of these tragedies occurring. But his mind just glossed right over it. And I mean, literally, it's a long book. If you go on YouTube, you can listen to it being read to you. And the shortest reading time, I think, was about an hour and 40 minutes or something. There's a lot of text in there. And the whole thing is just about the kind of confusion that people go through trying to understand why something's happened in their lives. And to me, what I see the article as being is helping people to build the brain cells for the principles of healing so that the principle becomes obvious. And where his healing occurs, you know, the whole book, you know, we've talked about this over and over again, the power person dynamic. What's the number one pseudo-solution of the non-being mind? If I could just figure this out, I'll figure it out in my brain, and if I can't, then Eliphaz will figure it out for me or whatever the other guys are. His three friends come and they do a couple of rounds of conversation. Everybody's got an opinion. Everybody's got somebody to blame. And virtually the whole conversation, I mean, right down to where it's blaming God. And where does the healing happen? The healing happens. Remember Yeshua said the power of life and death is in our words? You read that whole book and the healing happens when two things occur. Job recognizes that he has a habit, and his habit is his fear that his children aren't going to do it right. I mean, they say this is his habit. He does this all the time. And then, as I say, very early in the book, he says, oh, that which I feared most has come upon me. That's what I dread. This happened. And then he goes on because he has no idea. He's told himself what the problem is. And he listens to all these people, and there's a big conversation with God. Job blames God, and I mean, the whole thing. But again, listen to Yeshua. The power of life and death is in our words. His healing happened. I mean, of an hour and 45 minutes or so to read the text, within the last three lines, or four lines, whatever it is, two things that set him on a healing path, and everything's rectified. The first thing he does is he takes his words back. And then what it says is he becomes a space of conscious, active, present love for his friends. Now, they say he prays for his friends. And there's a big misunderstanding about that word, prayer. Most everybody's, you know, we're putting our order into the cosmic gift catalog, and it certainly sounds like that's where it's going. But in Aramaic, prayer means to set a trap for God, to literally And when you realize the Creator is love, and in Him, in that energy field, we live, move, and have our being. And because two energy fields interact, there's a transfer of energy. But the transfer of energy from that field in which we live, move, and have our being to the state of being where we are the presence of love, and that's where the resonance happens, they classified that as the still small voice. Because it's subtle, it's quiet. And with all the noise, I mean, you read through the book and all the noise of all these friends, and I mean, his wife even says, why don't you just kill yourself? And literally, that's what she says. Gee, you're in such terrible shape here. Why don't you just, you know, curse the Creator and kill yourself? All the noise, all the confusion, all of the conversation that has nothing whatsoever to do with the principles of healing. He realizes it was his words. He takes them back. And then he chooses to go to a space of connected, active, present love. And everything turns around. What do most people do? Oh, they go to Eliphaz, and they go to this neighbor, and they go to that neighbor, and they go to mom, and they go to dad, and they go to son, and their heads roll and rock and try to figure it out. It took 2,000 years for somebody to come forward. You know, maybe closer to 2,200 years. He was approximately 2,280, they estimate. So it took about 2,200 years for somebody to come forward and say, here is the core of how you heal. First of all, you recognize the power of life and death is in your word, and you recognize that what you ask for, you have a contract with the Creator, and the Creator is obligated to give it to you. And, of course, we've got lots of conversation. Well, it was God's will, you know. Well, God did it to me. I guess I'll just have to live with it. And when he went to the space of connected love, when he corrected his words, his life turned around. If you got the eyes to see and the ears to hear that, it's a powerful piece of work. So we're hoping that, I should say I'm working toward getting that all in a way that it's clear enough that somebody who doesn't have the eyes to see and the ears to hear, got to have the brain cells. Yeshua talks about, you know, he who having eyes does not see, who having ears does not perceive. If you don't have the brain cells, you can't recognize what it is you're looking at. You know, there's a device sitting over there on the desk. And most people would walk in and look at the device and go, well, there's some wires and there's some glass and there's some metal container. Yeah, well, that's a metal thing with wires and glass. Somebody else who's got the eyes to see and the ears to hear, the brain cells, looks at it and goes, oh, there's an X-ray machine. But if you don't have those eyes and ears, you don't see an X-ray machine when you look at an X-ray machine. I mean, you see one, but your brain can't give you an accurate definition of what it is unless you've got the brain cells where your mind can replicate that. And then the flip side of that coin, of course, is to recognize if your mind can replicate something, then you've got the brain cells for it. And if it's based in hostility or fear, you better get cleaning it out because it's going to have an impact. You want to withdraw those words from your mind. You want to forgive that content from your mind to be freed of whatever that is that your mind can see. And build the brain cells for what does healing look like? What are the principles? What are the principles by which this universe operates? There's so much when we, and this to me really applies so deeply to this whole work we're doing with the Enlightenment book and the Aramaic. We're on page 83. Well, let me, before I go there, let's ask Jeannie if there's anybody on the phone queue with a hand up or anything in the chat room, sweetie.
It's all quiet on this end.
Cool. So we're on page 83 in the manuscript. And there's a note under the word home. And you got to have the eyes to see and the ears to hear. Otherwise, things just don't make sense. So if we look at the note about a third of the way down the page, it's actually speaking about a passage from Matthew in the Beatitudes, where the first Beatitude, we're told by the Greeks, says, "Blessed are they who are poor in spirit." Now, when you're listening to the teachings of a man who's said, "You could deny me, but don't deny that spirit that I came to connect you with," it's a pretty big stretch to start telling somebody that's supposed to be poor in that thing which he said was most important to connect with. And as subtle a difference as this changes the whole meaning of that text, of that one beatitude. So phonetic dots in Aramaic in the text over second letter indicates it should be pronounced as an A. This change in phonics, without a change in spelling, changes the meaning from poor to home. Phonic dots came into the Aramaic script around the end of the first century, indicating Matthew was rendered into Greek prior to the time and without benefit of the phonetic markings. So the markings weren't there. You just had to know the context of what you were reading in order to pronounce the word correctly. So we hear the Greeks render this instruction, the first beatitude: "Blessed are they who are poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." In Aramaic, what we hear is a latent neural structure implanted by the Creator to guide you to happiness and well-being becomes your conscious possession, you whose home is in the eternal forces from God, or the Ruach HaKodesh. For you will inhabit, or you will live in, the community of love, kingdom of heaven. Now, you know, what a difference two little dots on a page make. I mean, which world would you rather live in? One where you were brought up saying, "Blessed are you who are poor in spirit, for yours is the kingdom of heaven," or "There's a latent narrow structure in you implanted by the Creator to guide you to happiness and well-being, and it becomes your conscious possession if you live in, if you have your home in the eternal forces from the Creator rather than in your head." You know, we look at that whole book of Job, and we got a bunch of people who are all in their heads, all trying to figure it out, all in a thing called perception, which is nothing but a reflection of something from the past. You know, by its very definition, the fact that something is perceived by the mind means the mind has made up a construct about it. And the mind makes its constructs out of the content of this body-mind unit, this carbon-based system that we call the body-mind unit. In order to reflect the content, obviously the content had to be there, which means everything we see in perception is from the past. Now, we can, correcting the mind, get it to the point where it will give us accurate information about what's going on in the world, but it still can't give us what's going on in the world, the actuality. It can only give you your mind's interpretation, your mind's construct out of what's resonated from the past in you. What we're looking to do is to free people, you know, we've said it over and over, in order to heal, you've got to be out of your mind. To free people from the mind so that we can literally be alive in our higher senses at every moment and experience from a connected space of love, because that's the first law that keeps the mind on track. Remember when they said to Yeshua, what's most important in the law? He said, have rachma filter in the frontal lobes of the brain. That allows your mind to only use data to form its intentions, data that's based in love. So we get to move toward the actuality instead of living in the cheap copy that the mind has. And if you read Job, this is what came clear to me actually this morning. I was working on the writing, and what became clear was, oh, that's it. Why is this whole conversation with Job? I mean, they go through this and that, and I mean, it just goes such a long, drawn-out conversation. Trying to figure it out. You can't figure it out. But you can forgive it. You can always collapse pain perception and bring the parts of the mind that hold data based in hostility or fear forward in the presence of love for healing. And as you do that, your home will not be in your mind, as this particular beatitude instructs. Your home will be in the actuality, in the eternal forces from the Creator, Ruka Dikudsha. And, you know, that'd be comparable to, let's imagine, you know, we've got somebody who they were brought up with a computer in front of them, and they can't do any behavior without going to what the computer screen shows them and tells them, and can only do what the computer screen instructs them to do. Obviously, if it's on a computer screen, it's from the past in the computer, and it's not actual. It's the same thing with the human mind. Great device, useful, has its place. It just can't give you the taste or the experience of actuality. That's why it's so important to understand how to collapse it. And then you rest in, no matter what's going on in your world. You know, I can remember being a kid and seeing pictures of the saints and in their suffering, you know, an arrow in the back or whatever. I was like, how is that possible? Now I know how it's possible. Those people were not living in their body's minds. They were living in the actuality, and in the actuality, there's full contact with serenity and the active presence of love, whatever's happening in the world. It's a mind that injects all of that other stuff. You know, there's a whole field in this. This was another piece. I'm working on reorganizing the title a little bit. There's a whole field of conflict resolution. That's a pseudo-solution of the non-being mind. It's not a, now, can conflict resolution be a benefit? Oh, absolutely, sure. If there's a big conflict going on, you can resolve it. Hey, cool. But did you heal anything? It's the healing that's important. It's not the conflict resolution. There's never going to be an end to conflict in the world. There's never going to be an end to war in the world, because war and conflict are constructs of the mind, unless we know how to rid ourselves of those constructs of the mind. There's where the solution to war is. People are going, oh, we need another accord. Let's get another group of people together, and let's see if we can resolve this conflict. Okay, so there's an issue, and resolve it. So what? You haven't resolved conflict, because conflict is a construct in the mind. And you haven't resolved the resultant wars that happen when there are conflicts until you resolve that structure in the mind, until you forgive that structure in the mind. How do you do that? You give up words, as Job did in just those last few lines of the text. You give up those words of hostility and fear, and you step into a connected space of active present love. In other words, you claim your human life. And the mind wants to jump in with all its stories and all its, you know, all those conversations, that whole, you know, hour and a half of conversations. And he'll pick up the tools, do the work, collapse the mind, be out of your mind, and all of a sudden you're being guided by the eternal forces, literally from the Creator. And so, I'm thinking we have pretty much covered the, I maybe missed some of my notes, covered the dictionary in the text. And so, let's open the floor and see if we have anybody out there with a question. Calling number, if you're on one of those stations where we can't see you, 563-999-3581. If you call that number, you're listening to the show directly. And then if you push 1, Jeannie will recognize you have something to share, and she'll introduce you by your area code. So if you're out there in listener land, push 1. Let's have a conversation.
It's all quiet.
Miss Jeannie, do we have anything exciting happening out there?
Nope, it's all quiet here.
Everybody's quiet today, okay. I was hoping we might be able to open some conversation.
I will announce we have 11 more what's called shorts on our YouTube channel. These are less than 60-second clips. Most of them are around 30 or 45 seconds. Please give them a watch. And if you watch something, whether it's a short or a video, give a like as well. You know, we'll look at the statistics on the YouTube, and we're within 500 watches of being able to be monetized on the shorts. So we could use your support in that direction. And there'll be like 400 and some people have watched one short and only 2 people have liked it. You know, so clicking like helps.
For sure. And
oh,
going in and listening to, you know, we've got Why Is This Happening to Me Again? The whole workshop is now on the website. There's the explanation of how the worksheet works. There are hundreds of videos. And so it would be awesome if you folks could take some time, give a listen, and click a like, join the channel, and you've got a caller, so let's say hello.
Okay. And also, you know, you can click them and then go about doing other things at your home and listen. It's not that you have to sit in front of the screen the whole time. And their hand up, I believe, is Sunny, 765. You're on the air.
Hi, guys.
Hey, welcome, young lady.
Hey.
How are you? What's on your mind today?
Well, curious, which Aramaic manuscript would you suggest and where might a person locate that as we're doing our work with you to have, you know?
Well, actually, what we're going through and what we've done over the last 60 days or so is we've been going through a book we published called Enlightenment. It's what we published so far from the Kabor's manuscript. So if you want a copy of that, if you go to our website, you can go to our catalog and order it, but when you order it, it charges shipping automatically. We can't change that. But for those who are listening to the show, we've put out that we'll pay the shipping on it. So if you just go to whyagain.org, and at the bottom of the page, there's a donate button. The text is $25. PayPal charges whatever they charge, 3 or 4%, whatever it is. And so if you click the donate button and just do a donation of $26, we'll pay the shipping. And we'll get it out to you right away if you want a copy of it. So
and
that's
that
what we're looking
from.
And then enlightenment. So if you just if you do that donation and just put your name and address in and say, you know, it's for enlightenment, then we'll know what it's for and we'll get it off to you and we'll pay the shipping.
All right. Well, thank you for sharing that. I was just my fiance is here and he's done a great deal of work, like about 25 years study in the Hebrew and reflecting back and forth with Aramaic and the relationships thereof, and just now introducing you to him, was
awesome.
Curious as to the materials by which you function, or, you know, your baseline, you know, and functioning
right
from there on. So that would be the Kabboris manuscript.
Right.
Correct?
Yeah, the Kabboris is a manuscript that was found. It's actually called the Kabboris because it was found in the Kaibor River in Turkey back in the 1970s. By my partner, who you've heard me speak of before, Dan McDougall. He had sent an expedition there to find a complete Aramaic manuscript, and it's a copy of a 164 AD text. We've actually had the manuscript itself carbon dated twice at the University of Arizona, and they tell us that it's from approximately 1000 AD, plus or minus the actual vellum that it's printed on. Or been copied to, and the imprimatur on it says that it's a copy of a text from approximately 164 AD, so it makes it a copy of the oldest known New Testament. It's just the New Testament in Aramaic, and the translation work was done back in the 70s by a group of about 25 of the world's top Aramaicists, with a focus on, in particular, what were the psychological meanings? What was going on with the mind? What did they know about the mind? And, you know, that's, to me, has been the most profound and impactful thing, to understand how this human mind works, is the understanding from the Aramaic goes so many light years beyond anything that we find today in the culture. It's just amazing, you know, stuff that they talk about old fogies in the desert. How did they know that? Well, psychiatry, psychology hasn't even started to catch up with what they understood about mindsets, how the mind operated. You know, again, you look at the Beatitudes and the whole Beatitudes. I can remember being a kid and it was kind of like, well, the Beatitudes were this sort of this nice philosophy, but when you go to the Aramaic, what you find is it's actually a set of instructions. And the instructions are how to activate a latent neural structure in the mind that's been hidden, how to bring it back to the surface, bring it back to awareness. And so that opening word, tuvehun, in Aramaic is a three-part word and basically says, you know, there's a guidance system in you that's latent, that's hidden from you, and here are the steps. Here's what it'll take to resonate, to bring it back to activity in your mind. And so it's the same with the Lord's Prayer is when you go to that in the Aramaic, and actually if you go to our YouTube channel, there's a video on the Lord's Prayer. And what you find is it's not a prayer at all. Most people are shocked when I say that. It's like, because they do it every, you know, Sunday morning. It's like, what do you mean it's not a prayer? Well, let's go back and listen to what happened there. Obviously, the disciples were somewhat confused because they asked a question, something they didn't know about. If they knew all about it, they obviously wouldn't have asked, and they said, teach us to pray. They obviously didn't know what that meant, or they wouldn't have asked the question. And then, you know, I use the example of, let's imagine you come to me and say, Michael, I understand you're a voice coach and a singing teacher. Would you teach me to sing? Would I be teaching you to sing if I sang a song? No, of course not. I mean, you might learn something from my singing, but if I were going to teach you to sing, I'd be talking about, you know, your throat and your breath and your diaphragm and, you know, how to sing. So the disciples don't say, Yeshua, say a prayer. They say, teach us to pray. They don't know. They're obviously, there's some confusion about the idea. And so the word prayer in Aramaic is to set a trap for God. which sounds kind of strange in our culture, but when you realize that, say, for instance, the TV antenna on your roof is, if you would like to watch Channel 2, and that TV antenna is oriented properly, it's the right shape antenna, it's a trap for Channel 2. It brings the signal of Channel 2 into the TV, and the TV pours out this beautiful picture and sound into your home because there's a trap for that signal. Well, in exactly the same way, you know, the what was called the Lord's Prayer, it was a set of instructions for here's how you become, here's how you align yourself in order to become, to capture and pour out into the world the energy field of love in which you live, move, and have your being. That's what you're designed for. So it changes so many basic things when you have that Aramaic understanding. It's just monumental. And the way the mind works, Rachma, you know, a filter in the frontal lobes of the brain keeps the brain on track with love. Kuba, a filter in the back of the brain that keeps perception on track with love. There are just so many things that don't even start to come through in the Greek translations of the scriptures. So that's what we're working from, and there's some of the foundation of it. Hope it makes
Michael,
sense and fits. Yes.
It does. It brings about yet another question.
Good.
But about the past year, the expression, and with having more exposure through made here that into the Hebrew, the expression or terminology of the screen in Hebrew, and it's what? Masak, or the screen. Would that be much like the filter that you were referring to in Aramaic?
Well, I'm wondering in what context is that word used? I could imagine that perception would be referred to in the Hebrew as a screen. Now, there's some interesting, see if this relates. There's some interesting Harvard research. It's probably the most, or no, not probably, it is the most quoted research in psychological history. And this research was done at Harvard back in the 50s. And what they showed was, in the laboratory, they've got somebody hooked up to electrodes and they're measuring brain cell firings. And in a time frame where there are approximately 10,000 brain cells firing, the max amount of data that can go into conscious awareness is 9 bits. So you get to see this little tiny bit, 9 bits of data out of 10,000. And it's been estimated that in the same time frame, we're perhaps living in a 20 trillion bit world. So that 9-bit, I refer to it kind of metaphorically as the 9-bit mind. The actual laboratory stats were 7 plus or minus 2. So some people function off as little as 5 bits of data in order to build their perception. And that would be someone you'd say, well, they're kind of slow or not very bright. And up to 9 bits of data would be someone who's working on a genius level. And so I could see where that 9-bit shows up, where the construct of perception shows up, would be referred to as a screen. That makes sense, yes. I don't know if that's the context that it's coming from in the Hebrew, but that would make sense for me.
I think the last that we were able to deduce, you know, because Hebrew, it finds you, they couldn't make it more complicated if they tried. However, it's like the screen being what you put out should be your best and highest. Otherwise, garbage gets stuck in the screen. Therefore, what comes back from you when you're receiving, you know, from universe, from creator, what have you, whatever your preference to refer
direct
to.
Direct reflection.
Yes, direct reflection. Yeah. There you go.
Universe,
and there's nothing clogging up your screen.
Universe is resonance.
Yeah, there's no garbage in your screen, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that would be, in Aramaic, the filter. When they said to Yeshua, what's most important in the law? And law, in Aramaic, is not the rule of a superior, as the Greeks would tell us. You know, there's some guy up there that's insisting you better do it this way or you're in big trouble. In Aramaic, law is simply the way it works. So what's most important in the way it works to be a human being? And we're told that Yeshua told them that you were supposed to love your neighbor and love God as you loved yourself. which is totally and completely out in left field. That's one of the problems in the world. I say to people, stop loving your neighbor. Stop loving yourself. It's not even possible to do that because love isn't a verb. It's not something you can do. But instead of saying love your neighbor, and it's easy once you have the brain cells for what he said to understand how the Greeks made an error there, he said, have rachma for your neighbor. And rachma, again, is a filter in the frontal lobes of the brain that allows only information from the frontal lobes where intentions are stored that are keyed to love to become available to awareness. So it filters out everything based in hostility or fear. The negative and the destructive are filtered out by the activity of rachma. And since intentions are the raw material of goals, and this again, you know, this is how the Aramaic understood the mind to work, since intention are the raw material of goals, if rachma is set and everything that you're aware of in the form of intentions are based in love, then your goals have to also be based in love. Which means that when you set a goal, the corresponding filter to rachma, which is kubha, is activated. And now only units of perceptual memory in the back of the brain that are keyed to love can come forward to conscious awareness to form your perception, what comes up on the screen of awareness. And rachma and kubha set together were called perfect love. What did they say? Perfect love casts out fear. The mind can't produce a fear-based reality if rachma and kubha are active. It doesn't matter. I mean, you could be in the middle, cancel the thought of the most tragic, horrific event in history, and you'd still be connected to love. Because the truth about you is that you are love, and that rachma, that filter in the frontal lobes of the brain, is also a gateway that brings love into the human form. If that gateway is closed, then we have what's called a human form, but there's no human being in there because the human being is the created essence of love. And if the gateway shut down, which is what hostility and fear do, you notice if you ever watch somebody in their rages and such, kind of hard to find any love in there. It's because the gateway's closed down. So what Yeshua is saying is first and most important order of business is keep that active. Now your mind is fueled by love. And you can't produce a fear-based reality, so now you always have available to you the mind of active present love, which in the ancient teachings was called the mind of Christ. Nothing religious about it. We either live out of a mind of hostility or fear, or we live out of a mind of love. The mind of hostility and fear was called the mind of man. And then there was...
go ahead. Much like the reference that Yeshua gave, I don't know exactly where in passage, but he was asked a question like, aren't you upset? Aren't you, you know, And he said, it's not in my store.
Not in my store, yeah. Why don't you give them back some of their own medicine? I have none of that in my store. There's no, don't have any hostility here for to give them, so why would I do that? Yeah.
Right.
So that's the, and then if you recognize that either in the frontal lobes of the brain or the back of the brain, there is data that's based in hostility or fear, then he has the solution for how to get rid of it, how to literally remove it, and it's called forgiveness. And again, the Greeks turned forgiveness into, okay, I have pain moving inside of me, it's all your fault, but it's okay, I'll forgive you, I'll let you off the hook for the pain that's moving inside of me, which of course does nothing to change the pain that's moving inside of me. So never even attempt or think about loving anyone. Choose to function as love, and then you will automatically cherish, honor, and be of support to anyone you run into. It won't be about loving them. It'll be about functioning from love. And as you do that, everything in the perceptual mind changes. Every energetic pattern in physiology changes. Diseases disappear. You know, all the crazy things that have gone for generation and generation in our bloodline simply begin to disappear.
Yes. Being that silent observer, perhaps, right? Watching everybody's
movies. Well, the silent
movies.
Observer is the state of being. That's the created essence that we are. And, you know, Yeshua, there's another case where Yeshua talked about, well, in order for you to live, you've got to die. Which, you know, that doesn't make any sense if you don't understand what's being the mind in the Aramaic context. What he's saying is, in order for you being silent observer, created essence of love, to function through this body-mind unit, the self you, the world has taught you you are, the self based in hostility and fear and terror and trauma and drama, that self has to die. How do you make that self die? It's done through forgiveness. You remove the root of the false self that he said had to die, and as that false self, the literally as the energetic patterns of the false self are weakened, it literally dissipates and disappears, and it's then the whole energy system is run by your created human essence, which is love, human being. Again, the observer inhabits the form, and the whole game changes.
Right. The false self is maybe commonly referred to as the ego.
Ego, yes. Ego, edging God, love out.
Yeah. Beautiful, beautiful.
Hey, delighted. Does that all make sense from the Hebrew context that you're looking at it?
Yes, beautiful reflection. And yeah, they're not that far apart. I'm doing some research. It just occurred to me to, like, dig into that. And it is stated somewhere, I don't know how accurate it may be, that either way, the Hebrew is, or it was stated that Aramaic was a dialect of Hebrew. And then, therefore, Hebrew could be a dialect of Aramaic. So.
Yeah. You know, that's something that there's still, I think, the jury's out on that. It's been said that the Hebrew is actually a daughter language to the Aramaic. I'm not sure whether that's true or not. I have understood that to be true in the past, but I've seen evidence that has me question that. And but what I do understand is that it was the language, you know, like today, pretty much throughout the world, wherever you go, business is done in English. It's the lingua franca of the world. In, you know, 2,000 years ago, you could go from the Middle East to the Great Wall of China, and that was, Aramaic was the lingua franca. That's what the common people spoke. That was the language of business. That which is what was done. You know, for 3,000 years, the Persian Empire lived in peace with their neighbors under the Aramaic language. Hebrew, as I understand it, was spoken in the temple. It was the temple scrolls, but Aramaic was what the people worked with in the streets, and that's where Yeshua taught, was in the common language of the people, which was Aramaic.
Yeah, yes. And it's much like, you know, Spanish-speaking people, depending on their region of, you know, geographical region, they're going to have a different dialect. You can take, you know, the Spanish-speaking people from Texas, Spanish-speaking people from Mexico, and then those from Spain, put all three of them together, and they can't communicate with each other because they're all speaking a different dialect of what is said to be the same language.
I've never had that problem being here in the South.
I've experienced it, and I've, you know, again, it's, you know, people in Spain do not speak the same kind of Spanish. People in Mexico,
Castilian is a whole different thing.
Yeah, they speak a different form of that what is said to be the Spanish language, Spanish. It's quite a thing. So I'm excited to see where we expand our vocabularies in many ways.
Yeah, Winston Churchill is quoted as having said, "We have the privilege of being separated by a common language." And until you get people to harmonize the definitions of their words. And it was Plato that said, "Let me define the words, I'll end the argument." Because different people have different brain cells for a particular grunt that's made in any language it fires different brain cells in different people. And so everybody has different meanings, different realities within their minds. And when we free ourselves from the hostility and fear-based distortions, then all of a sudden things start to line up and start to make more sense.
Yes, which is yet another one of your workshops of, did you hear what I think I said?
Communication, did you hear what I think I said? Yes.
Yes.
Actually, over the period of the last 3 years or so, we've done two different codependence to interdependence communication practicums, and we combine them into a self-study, and we spend quite a bit of time. You know, the last time that you saw the communication worksheet, the communication rules worksheet that we put out, which again has got to be 7 or 8 years ago, it was a one page, and for the 25 or so years that I taught that workshop, it was always a one page workshop. But in this self-study intensive that we did on Zoom online, and we put together two intensives. The lady who was the example, she and her partner did a responsibility communication process in the intensive. We got this all on video. And for several years, she'd been at Heartland. She'd worked with the tools, and communication was her favorite tool. Well, because of her having that as her favorite tool and really working with it, out of that intensive, a one-page worksheet that had been in existence for 25 years was changed into 3 pages in that workshop. It really, I mean, her inquiry, her questioning, her having worked with it, and then bringing it up in the intensive really changed the whole game on the communication, the responsibility communication workshop.
Absolutely beautiful, Michael. Absolutely beautiful.
All right.
I'm
awesome.
So grateful for our reconnection and looking forward to here maybe in a day or two so I can set my focus, if we could, if you have a moment available with Jeannie. We'll put together some stuff. So both ways, I'll get things rolling and see where your interest may or may not lie. And yeah.
Do you have any recordings?
I truly don't.
Things that you've done?
We'll familiarize when we are able to, do a private phone conversation, familiarize the setting, be inviting you to share in. The people are very ready, but they're kind of all over the board, don't have the proper tools, and that's where you are needed. This work, of course, is yes. Definitely needed all over the world, and the initial vocabulary is there from them. The intention is there. That, again, they just don't have the tools. And it would be, I would dare say, right, from the first a minimum of 50 people present, and you know how that beautiful word spreads. And then if you decide to choose utilizing that particular format, that would be the onslaught of building that audience in that direction, then introducing that new format outwardly into the rest of your world, and just another avenue of approach, because we got to reach them all if we can.
But you don't have any audios or videos that you can just send me a link to that I can give a quick listen so I get more of a sense of it?
No.
Build some brain cells?
What I can do is get you in there and walk you through, get you into the audio part of that tool, and just kind of introduce you to a few people, and it's just an app in your phone. If it's not for you, just give it the click,
Cool.
And God will take it from there. But you will need more information than you're functioning from, and we won't burden your audience with that now.
And it'll be a couple of weeks, Nani, because we're getting ready to leave Friday morning early for vacation, and then Michael's going to Florida. So it'll be a little while.
Okay. Well, the idea was to do a quick run through, if we can, on a phone conversation for maybe, us. It may take us a minute, but you could do a quick phone conversation.
We've got so much on our plate between now and then. It'll be at least a couple of weeks before we can do that.
Okay. So I was hoping to get the stage ready for you and have you at least be a guest and see how that goes for you. And
cool.
Kind of timing.
Well,
it's beautiful right now.
Put Thank out you. Some of those links and we'll see what develops.
All righty.
Cool.
All right.
Blessings.
Yeah.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
All right, Ms. Dini, we've got about 5 minutes left. Do we have anybody out there in the phone queue with a hand up or anything else happening in the chat room?
No, it's all quiet. There was a comment in the Podbean that listening to Sunny talk, they said, the holy sibling talking is quite grounded. Great inner work.
Cool. Sweet. So if we go to page 42 in the text, that's where we left off. And we're on, so that's from the book of, let me turn back here. So we're in Matthew 5. We've been through the Beatitudes. There are some videos on our YouTube channel for the Beatitudes, as well as the last 60 or so shows covering this material.
And those are the Beatitudes part one is what's going to play on Friday while we're traveling. And then depending on how the schedule goes, part two, part three will come about within the next week or two.
Cool. Awesome. So if we, I'm going to just head back up to the top of page 42 in the text. And so in 5:16, he's saying, in like manner, let your light shine before men, so they will see your good works, and then give homage to your Creator, which is in the community of love. And then he speaks about law, and it's interesting that there's a particular passage where he's asked a question, and he answers when they ask him about the idea of what they called law. They were actually asking about the customs of the people, but he doesn't answer the customs of the people. He speaks of what's called in Aramaic nemosa. And many men have always wanted to free themselves from the law. And there are people out there talking about how, yeah, well, you see, we're free from law. We don't have any tie. It's like, well, okay. If you think that's true, I want to see you at the top of Mount Everest take a step off the edge of the cliff. And that's been a dream of men forever. So Yeshua here says, think not that I come to release the ties of the Nemosa or its prophets. I come not to release the ties, but to add into your understanding of them. So he's talking about, again, law being the way things work. What he's doing is he's inviting people to understand how this whole energy system works, that they're simply definable ways of understanding the principles. And if we're not willing to look at those principles, we might want to pretend that we're free of it, but there is no liberty from experiencing the effects of the way the energy system works. It's just the way it's set up. And so we're looking here to understand not that there's a burden to it. Actually, the liberty is in understanding how the energy field works, not ignoring it and pretend that it doesn't have anything to do with you. And then he goes on and he's really clear. He says, for truly I say to you, until Shemaiah, till the heaven and earth cease to exist, not one letter, not one stroke of the way it works will cease to exist. So looking to really comprehend that. And attuned to how this energy system really truly works when we function out of our created essence, our created state of being, which is that of love. So thanks for joining us. Our time is up for today. best year yet of your eternal life. It's an awesome gift to give the world. Blessings.